To critics, I started to say critic circle, to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and we're going to be talking to Fred Anderson, author of Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir. And there's a very important article that we're going to sort of focus on. Are you there, Fred Anderson?
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Great to hear your voice. I'm glad you... How are things going?
So far, so good, you know?
Yeah. I was very struck. There's a really important, in my view, discussion of your book by Ishmael Reed in Counterpunch magazine. It's published May 8, 2026. And his title is... Fred Anderson, North American writer, and of course he's talking about your book, Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, and of course you're in Montreal now, I suppose, and it's a memoir, but Ishmael Reed is really appreciative of the voices of black authors who have experienced racism and fought with race, fought against it, and have expressed themselves, and of course, found it necessary to leave the United States. He cites several authors going back to pre-Civil War times, and I was very happy to see that he put you in that canon, I guess we could say, the canon of those who have had to go abroad. They didn't want, it wasn't a choice, and maybe in some cases it was cultural, that is, that they felt, I just can't live here. I guess Richard Wright would be an example. But it gave a perspective. How did you react to that article? What did you think of that point of Ishmael Reed?
Well, I think he very adequately situates the book within that tradition of resistance, exile, and a visualizing of resistance in an international context. And that was certainly one of the things that I wanted to focus on in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why within my head and my concept, I view the book in some way as reimagining the Underground Railroad. And at one point, I wrote, I mean, little did I know that my journey would hurl me into the ancestral narratives of runaway slaves.
Mm-hmm. This idea of exodus, it caused me to think about people have forgotten there's a phenomenon in American history called the Great Migration.
Exactly.
Which, by the way, I mean, I hope you can talk about that. But the thousands of black Americans under the Klan-enforced segregation picked up and moved or were driven out. But it's an interesting phenomenon because it's like the wave went one way, but then, of course, their winning their way in the so-called, you know, free North, they were an altered population. That fed back into the struggle against segregation in the South, didn't it?
It absolutely did, and that's one of the great stories of the fight for America, democracy, and the struggle to complete the unfinished business of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And one of the ironies is that there has been much reporting in the last 10 years of a reverse migration,
Yes.
Of so many of the ancestors, those people who did that original migration, were now returning to the South because they saw the opportunity of a greater advancement in the South than they did in a lot of the northern cities. And of course, the irony of that now blows up with the U.S. Supreme Court gutting the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Amazing.
Yes. Yeah. The this is really rich ground. But I should tell listeners, you got to get the book because this is a gentleman who, at the age of 15, opened his front door and decided to join the storm of struggle against legalized segregation and got bounced around for that. And in the book, you say, well, we've reached this point, and I think we could maybe the date would be 1965. And the struggle had advanced to a certain point, and you write that you know that the people have changed, and they're not going to go back. But, of course, there's that enemy on the other side of the bridge who says you're going to go back. We're entering another phase founded where the foundation of the struggle is where you were in 1964-65.
Absolutely. This is very, very disheartening, you know, and it's a body blow. But I think that people have to stand fast and realize that it's not a time to despair. You know, over the last month or so, I've been writing a series of poems about the cycle of resistance and resilience. I'll share with you the one that I just completed a couple of days ago in the face of what's happening, and it's entitled "Let's Not Despair." Let's not despair, though the night has learned to stretch itself over cities like barbed wire and smoke. Let's not surrender to the arithmetic of loss, to headlines sharpened into weapons, to the slow corrosion of hope. We have endured before, not untouched, never untouched, but unbroken in the places that mattered most. The tree survives the winter, not by denying the cold, but by holding life quietly beneath the bark. So let us be like that, rooted, stubborn with spring. When they silence one voice, let another rise from kitchens, buses, classrooms, from the tired hands and crowded streets. Resistance is not always a banner. Sometimes it is feeding a child, telling the truth softly, refusing to hate when hated is fashionable. And resilience. Resilience is the scar that does not apologize for healing. Let's not despair. The dawn has always depended on those who kept walking through the dark, believing morning would come.
Wow. Where was that published? That's a lovely poem. Powerful
poem. It's not published. I just wrote it 2 days ago.
Well, it's going to be published. We need to raise up your voices. We need them all. So much of the victory comes from endurance.
Absolutely.
That's a hard lesson.
And
you don't get to have parades.
No, exactly. And just the reality is that we've done it before when so many thought it was impossible. Yeah. It's never too dark to find the light if we struggle.
You know, I was reading Martin Luther King made a speech there. It's post-Selma. I want to ask you about Selma, but that He said, we're waiting for America to develop a conscience, and it will. And, you know, this is so painful to go through. Selma, there was a demonstration 2 days ago at the bridge.
Yes, yes.
At the bridge. And this issue of, well, I got to tie it into your book, and it is so heartbreaking, but damn it, and in a way, I'm glad that the Klan types can't, you know, are sick, because sick people can't win out in the long run. But, you know, the name, you're from Forest County. You lived on Lee Street.
Yes.
Okay, so that's Bedford Forest, right? And I have to assume that Lee would be the one and only. And Pettus Bridge is named for the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan of Alabama.
All right. Hey, it's a...
Confederate general.
Yep. Parody is reality.
So. And they call that tradition.
Now,
you know, the desperation, the bloody desperation of the Confederate South to hang on to those names, and the way Trump has jumped in. And by the way, Ishmael Reed, of course, he reads your book and he says he's seething, angry, that we're in a situation where you can have a president who would, he didn't, this was not part of his thesis, but it adds in, that maintains the names of the slaveocracy as honored names.
Well, if you look at, I look at Mississippi in particular, but it's something that's across the South and across the United States. In particular, when I became an organizer for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I would have to go to all of these different counties to organize. And what was striking was that so many of those counties bore the name of Native American tribes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which just stands in contrast to the underlying history of the way the South resettled and eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so many Native Indigenous American tribes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it they mark it. It's almost like a kind of cultural cannibalism, right?
Precisely.
It's like, you know, we got a Geronimo helicopter and an Apache. And you say, so in other words, you're not yourself not a warrior. You're naming a warrior. You're naming your thing after him. He's the one who did the fighting.
Exactly.
But you ate him. I mean, this is not a happy picture. We're speaking, by the way, I want to tell everybody, eyes have seen from Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir, Fred Anderson. And it is, I think it's part of the American canon. I think American Library should be publishing. I forget what the name of that outfit is, but they do a good job of putting out American books. They put, I think James Baldwin is in that. It passes for a canon, and bless their hearts. But this book, Eyes Have Seen, belongs there. So, again, now, of course, the title of his piece is A North American Writer, because here you are a veteran. By the way, you must have been, I guess, 20, 21 at the oldest when you arrived in Montreal. And you had your scars. You'd been locked up.
I was 19, yeah.
You were 19. Did it surprise you? Did you notice that this people called the separatists in Quebec were modeling themselves on the Black American struggle?
Oh, absolutely. People
don't seem to remember.
absolutely. I marveled on that, you know, and I I was honored enough to meet and be in discussion with a number of the pivotal separatist independence leaders, and that was part of my discussions. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember getting to know and establish a relationship with Dr. Jacques Vadon. Mm-hmm. Who was a key leader in the separatist movement, who founded the Rhinoceros movement.
Ah, yes.
And who's wrote a number of very wonderful books, which we discussed for a long time, you know.
Mm-hmm. But it might, by the way, it's a validating thing, isn't it, to look out and say, gee, these guys want to follow me.
Yeah. But, I would point out, I appreciate that, but I felt there was also a number of distortions in the comparison.
Yes.
And when you think how they shaped this province, and we're in the year 2026. Mm-hmm. You know, and yet, you know, we have successive provincial governments who absolutely refuse to acknowledge that systemic racism exists in this province.
Exactly. But I'm really glad Ishmael Reed called attention to that. There used to be, you remember when Malcolm X said, when they talk about the South, they must mean from Canada down? And then you arrived in Montreal and you say, well, maybe we better move that to the Arctic. I don't think in the Arctic they have a lot of racism. Certainly not the people there, the indigenous people.
Right.
You were in a storm. Don't we have to acknowledge that there were so many voices? And you're telling a very courageous story, and that is how wonderful a group that SNCC was, and what a marvel of leaders, and they faced terrible repression, but yes. and achieved something. I mean,
absolutely. But the thing for me is that what breaks my heart about these reversals and gutting of these gains, it's like what breaks my heart is like it's spitting on the graves of so many people that I worked with and that I knew who made the ultimate sacrifice to bring about these changes.
Yes. You know, again, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because in looking into it, but I happened to focus because of the Selma thing. There were so many lives lost there at Selma in the lead up and post, where the Klan simply knocked them off, and their names are
absolutely
not known. Their names are not known.
Yeah.
And terrible price. Now, you were aligned with at one point in the book you discussed the fact that you said you were referred to as an acolyte of Bob Moses.
Yes.
And a crisis occurred. I don't know how it could not have, because given the weight of social political pressures, he said, we have to bring on a crisis. And I guess he didn't use the word strike while the iron is hot, you might say. He said, when people have to see things for what they are. And so you went through a summer, the Freedom Summer of 64, which led to the Civil Rights Act of 64.
Yeah,
and then there was
the
body blows of Selma, which led to the Voting Rights Act,
exactly,
which are at this very moment under attack once again, including, by the way, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, I believe, in the American Constitution, are clearly threatened.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a bit?
Well, you know, how to put it. Those amendments were brought in to address the aftermath of slavery, and to try and put the ex-slaves in terms of enfranchisement on an equal electoral basis. Because prior to that, those rights just didn't exist, particularly in the South. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people fully understand the full context of that when they discuss what this means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the nub of it. It's so at the end of the Civil War, America found itself with a question it hadn't actually faced, which was, okay, you're against slavery, but are you against racism? And the most evil president in American history, Andrew Johnson, the one who he pardoned Pettus 7 months after the war. General Pettus, founder of the Klan in Alabama, the Grand Dragon, he pardoned him.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that meant that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment did not apply in the South.
Exactly. You know, and the favorite president of the current president, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. It's the same. Ishmael Reed's got his finger on that one, and he's not going to let it go. By the way, he wrote a great book called Reckless Eyeballing.
Yes.
And it really summarizes, okay, this problem, does America actually have a conscience? His story is about the young man who allegedly whistled at a white woman and ended up murdered. And you had a cousin?
Same with Emmett Till, and the same with my cousin, Sammy Johnson Jr.
And that power of enforcement is in their hands. I just wonder, let me just skip to another issue. Your last big project before you had to escape from America because they were drafting anti-racist militants like yourself.
Right.
Your project was working to save farmers' lands to try to protect black farmers.
That was in Albany and Cordelia, Georgia. It was a new phase that SNCC was taking on, and it was unfolding across the South as one of our priorities. You know, we were on that front in Mississippi and in Alabama and Southwest Georgia. So when I was transferred to Albany, Georgia, I took on that part of one of our priorities.
That's one of the scarier stories in your book, because that was a confrontation of the Klan farmers and chasing away black farmers. And these are serious men on both sides. They're not actually, they're not ordinary protesters. That was a rough moment.
Far from it. You know, I still wake up in a cold sweat all these years later, remembering those incidents and scenes.
Yeah, I hope people have to read this book to understand. I can't emphasize that enough. Now, on the matter of, you say, and I don't know if we use the expression of a kind of a victim of their own success, but SNCC became so central that it actually caused a decline, right? Because then it became a kind of, who's going to lead this thing? And
it was a question of who's going to lead it, but that had always. That had always been a driving issue from SNCC's inception, you know, and so there's nothing surprising about that. But I also the the downfall of SNCC has more to do with counterintelligence and infiltration and provocateurs.
FBI.
Yes.
That they're slandering and the spreading of lies and myths.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The FBI, when they were part of that search, maybe it might have been at Selma. The FBI, they immediately began to spread lies about people involved. I guess it was, now I'm thinking about it, it was the Liuzzo case, the woman from the Teamsters Union who was shot around Selma. And the FBI put out stories about her sex life. She abandoned her children and took up with a black person.
It's an old playbook that's still in play.
It works. Works like a charm.
Look at the lies and disinformation that they spread about the two people that ICE killed in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. They made the woman who was shot several times in the head.
Yeah.
She was the source of the problem.
Right. Exactly.
She was driving a car instead of crawling down the street. Right. I guess.
Exactly. Exactly.
But they, the model doesn't change. I hope people see that it is. You know, yes, we have incremental gains, but in terms of the enemy of progress, they always use the same dirty tricks. They don't abandon those tricks.
No, not at all.
And by the way, you tell them, and I was noticing it, I was reading again last night, you talk about this difficulty. After people should understand it, you were living under another name for a very long time in order to survive stay out of the hands of the FBI.
The first 11 years in Canada. Yep.
Yeah. Now, but you write there that the problem of, I guess the expression is going underground. The problem, you speak of it as creating a personal crisis because you have to deceive people. And these are people that you like. They're counting on you. They know they can count on you, except that you're not who they think you are because you've had to go underground. Could you talk about you? Because there's a couple of paragraphs that I found it very poignant, that the problem is no matter what your intention, once you are in that having to deceive, it is very hurtful.
Well, you know, as I write in the book, you know, when I was finally legalized and could disclose who I truly were, there were some people who were, from their point of view, justifiably hurt and disappointed, and who saw no way to continue a relationship going forward. Thankfully, there were many others who felt different. Now, you know, and we continue to be friends and colleagues, even till this till this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I write in the book, I mean, as Frantz Fanon said, I mean, truth is the property of the national cause. You do what's necessary to survive, and you do what's necessary to continue to resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does take its toll.
There's no doubt about that. It absolutely does. You know, although I must say, during that period, there were people in the communities who were trusted leaders that I knew who I could count on. There were a few. Mm-hmm. Who I disclosed my true identity early in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and that's again what the price of confronting a powerful enemy is: having to work on your own identity to fight back.
Exactly.
Do you have moments when you miss being Clifton Gasson?
Oh, that's a very, very good question. You know,
he did a lot of great work.
Yeah, it's impossible for me not to miss Clifford Gaston, because we were childhood friends when we were growing up. I mean, we did everything. Yeah. Everything together. And so being him in Canada was just a continuation of that relationship.
By the way, aren't you carrying on for him in this? I read a story once by someone who joined the anti-fascist cause. He and his brother joined together. The brother died, and he says, "Well, I'm living for both of us now."
Well, that is so true, and that will forever be the case with Clifford and I.
And you returned to Hattiesburg and found his grave, killed in Vietnam at 65.
Absolutely. I had absolutely no idea until I was visiting the graveyard,
which was almost washed away.
Yes, right. In search of my mother's grave, and I stumbled upon his tombstone. I had no idea.
That's a burden, and an honor, I think.
Yeah, you know.
I really hope you're going to continue working on. If you've always been writing poems, I think you've been hiding from us. We need to know. We need to read these poems.
No, I started off writing poetry.
Uh-huh. Said, we got to get them between covers. We don't have you. Someone could go and collect them, right? I mean, they're already the published.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what Baraka Book does. You know, although my next project. with Baraka Books is a collection of short stories about black women in the South. That's the next project.
Oh, good.
And and we do now have the date of March 2027 when Webster's translation of Eyes Have Seen will appear.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that this is being done, because I know I have the phrase in my head from your book that you said it was Hattiesburg was strong men and stronger women.
And stronger women.
And
yeah.
every mother on the street was your mother.
Yeah, that's right. Every mother was entitled to give you an ass whipping and send you home with the next ass whipping awaited.
And there's so many people. I hope there are stories fleshing out those that you refer to in the book where you learn so much, because they let you sit around as a little boy and listen to them talk.
Absolutely.
And what a rich vocabulary and humor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this coming Saturday, there's a book launch by the marvelous Montreal black historian, Dr. Dorothy Wills. She's published two volumes called The ABCs of Black History, where she recounts the stories of a lot of black people. Mm-hmm. And she invited me to be at the book launch and read one of the courageous heroes in the book. Mm-hmm. And she told me to choose one, and I chose one, and I told her I wanted to read that because my first discovery of this character was at my grandmother's quilting bee, mm-hmm. when she told the story of this character. So I chose that one to read next Saturday.
You know, this story's got to be known, and Fannie Lou Hamer. I notice that everybody, if you want to make your case, talking about Mississippi Freedom Summer, start with Fannie Lou Hamer, who was utterly fearless.
Absolutely. One of the most inspirational people you could possibly meet.
I once ran into her in Los Angeles, and she was she opened her speech. She said, all you FBIs better hit the door because I'm going to tell the truth.
Yeah.
she had me in the palm of her hand. I got to ask you, are you aware of Carolyn Randall Williams? Who?
Yes.
My goodness, she wrote an essay in the New York Times saying, "You want a Confederate monument? My body is a Confederate monument." She is the DNA great great granddaughter of Edmund Pettus.
Yes.
Who raped her great great grandma, who was his servant.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also descended from Arna Bontemps.
Yes. Yeah. Arna Bontemps. I mean, one of my favorite people. I mean, one of the guiding lights of the Harlem Renaissance, you know?
Yeah. All we
marvelous.
Need. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
No, I just say all we need is actually, please, somebody open the doors and publish all these things, and everybody, you know, return to singing the great songs, because it's a whole vast culture which has been suppressed, and it's a beautiful culture. Your book reveals that. You write as much about music and food and family life as a foundation for every good thing that happened there.
Right. Well, you know, I must say how touched I was. You know, the last person that I expected to get a review from was Ishmael Reed. Mm-hmm. You know, he is just so iconic for me.
Yes.
You know, when I first arrived in Montreal in November 1966, and I went into a bookstore, and one of the first books I purchased was Ishmael Reed. And I have subsequently purchased, I must have every book he's ever written. So mm-hmm. It was just such a major honor that Ishmael would review my book. Unbelievable.
Yeah, he is actually, people use this old-fashioned expression, a man of letters. He actually is.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
one of the few.
Exactly. Yeah.
And he takes on American history. He got them to, he exposed the story of, you know, of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
And he pointed out that Arthur Schlesinger, the marvelous Northeastern blue blood liberal, wrote about Jackson and did not talk about the the removal of indigenous people from the eastern coast of the United States.
Exactly.
You know, they changed. Everybody got down and said, Ishmael's right.
Yep.
And he did the same now with Alexander Hamilton.
Exactly.
They were going to put a black woman, Harriet Tubman, on the, was it the $10 bill?
Yeah,
and then they said, "Oh no, Hamilton's so marvelous."
And well, you know, Ishmael and that tradition, you know, that he speaks of. I mean, he's so much a part of that. I mean, his book, "Flight to Canada,"
mm-hmm.
is one of the most incredible reads ever.
Absolutely,
on that whole tradition.
Yeah, he also said something which speaks to your book. He says, writing is fighting.
Yep.
That was, a collection of essays. Actually took it from Muhammad Ali. It turned out Ali said, I can write.
Somebody, right.
And he did it.
Yep.
And they said, oh, no, you're not from Harvard. You can't write.
Right.
Writing is fighting. No, Ishmael Reed is a monument. What a bulldog. Boy, don't tangle with that man.
No.
We've been very privileged to talk to him a few times. He wrote a great book, by the way, on the life of the fighter Muhammad Ali. And it is truly, and that's an honest book. I mean, he really gets into it.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just highlight. It's not a highlight reel.
No.
And it gives me one last chance. I can't resist asking. You must have gotten a huge lift out of the presence of Muhammad Ali.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we all knew his story. I mean, you know, my dad was such a huge boxing fan.
Yeah, we have to go from Joe Louis to Ali, right? Louis carried the struggle too.
Yeah. You know, and we sat around that radio. And we listened to the Gillette Cavalcade, and we heard all those fights, you know?
Me too. No, frankly, we have to face it. Wasn't that, I mean, because of their stupidity, the white power structure made everything stand on the idea they were the toughest. And then, of course, the toughest didn't want to fight black fighters.
Exactly.
And then when it happened... Oh, my gosh. We have to say Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali. Who is the greatest?
Yeah. You know, Jack Johnson and the whole great white hope.
Yeah. No, psychologically, I mean, you have to, you know, that's kind of right along with SNCC and all the organizing. It's, you know, they say, well, get in the ring and find out. Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
And the existential moment, because so much is riding on it. You know, phenomenal. Well, it's because of people like yourself, Fred Anderson, author of Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir, and the great Ishmael Reed, who said writing is fighting. And I'm really glad to hear about these poems. We're going to get a hold of that poem so that we can... As a matter of fact, we've got you recorded. We can play it. I assume we have your permission. We could play that.
You do indeed. You do indeed.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you. I hope everybody gets this book, Baraka Books, and look forward to talking again sometime.
Thanks a lot, Phil. Very much appreciated. Have a good day.
Same to you. That's Fred Anderson, Eyes Have Seen, Baraka Books. And this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break. It's Sweet Honey and the Rock, and we're going to come back and talk to Tony Leah.